Committee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for Thursday, February 10th. The first party on the agenda is Brian Reeder, who will be talking to us about the quality education model.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Reeder. I'm the Director of Policy Research and Analysis Section at the Department of Education. What I would like to do today is give you a very brief demonstration of the quality education model, really the technical aspects of the model, to show you how the model is used to make estimates of impacts of policy proposals. I'm not going to talk about all the aspects of the model, but limit my demonstration here to really the mechanics of how the model works. And I will reiterate my offer to each of you that I can provide you with a copy of the model and also give you a one-on-one demonstration and tutorial if you would like that. With that, I will open up the model here, and this page I'm on here is one that you may be familiar with. We present this in the report of the model. This is really what I consider the guts of the model. It shows the prototype schools. As you know, the model is built around what we call prototype schools, one each for the elementary, middle, and high school level. And the philosophy behind this is that we construct a prototype that is a highly efficient, highly effective school, and then determine the resources needed to run that school based on what we know about best practices and the staffing levels and other inputs required to run such a highly effective school. As you can see, we start out here with information about teacher salaries, principal salaries, salaries or wage rates of classified employees, information about benefits. This one right here, $9,000 per employee is comprised almost exclusively of health insurance benefits, and those we represent as a dollar amount rather than as a percentage of salary, because they typically are given not based on a share of salary, but as a fixed amount for each employee independent of their salary. And then there are other elements of the benefits package, which are primarily federal taxes and PERS, which are a function of salary levels, and so those enter the model as a share of salary. As you can see, we have staffing levels for different grades: kindergarten, grades 1 through 3, grades 4 through 5, and these are set in order to achieve a given class size level. Before I continue, maybe I should back up a little bit. As you know, when the first model was built back in the late, back in 1999, it presented an estimate of what it would take to get 90% of Oregon students to meet the state standards. That was a number that was quite large and shocking to quite a few people. It became clear to the commission rather quickly that the model wasn't going to be terribly useful unless we could start where we are today and build on it rather than start at a hypothetical desired level of resources and work backwards. So what we did the next couple of years was to recalibrate the model to current conditions. It's what we call the baseline scenario in the model, and I'll show you that in just a few minutes. But I mention it now because the the staffing levels that you're seeing in front of you right now are the ones that exist today. They're not the ones that the model of the fully implemented model, they are the resource levels that exist in Oregon schools today. And these, for example, in kindergarten, to achieve the class sizes that we observe in kindergarten today, in the prototype would involve 0.83 FTE of a kindergarten teacher. Now, that may sound a little bit funny to you because we don't have 0.83 teachers in our schools, but we're dealing with averages here. And so in the prototype, elementary school has 340 students in it. 40 of those are kindergartners, and to achieve a current class size, which is around 24, requires less than one teacher. So on average, we have less. We would have less than one kindergarten teacher in a school of 340 students. Now, obviously, we have schools of varying sizes. A larger school might have two kindergarten teachers. A much smaller school might have a half-time kindergarten teacher. On average, a school of this size would have 0.83.
So just to clarify, with our current classroom sizes on average in all school districts, if we had an elementary school with 340 students, this is the number of teachers that you would have in that elementary school for kindergarten students. If you had the hypothetical 340 students in the total elementary school, this is the average count that you might have for kindergarten.
Chair Dittlin, that's correct. That's correct. Similarly, for grades 1 through 3, to achieve the class sizes we actually observe today would take 7.2 FTE of grade 1 through 3 teachers in a school of this size.
Hypothetically, then, you could take any school district and apply its current situation and get some hypothetical estimate for what it would cost to operate that school or school district.
Chair Devlin, that's correct. And we've actually, there are a number of school districts out there that have taken the model and tried to tailor it to their own circumstances and using it as a tool to help them understand how their resources are being allocated. As we step down through this, you see we have in the elementary schools, we have staff for special programs such as music and PE. These would be staff that are outside the regular classroom teachers. In many cases, these are itinerant teachers which travel from school to school to do art or music or PE. They may be, this grouping here would also include specialists in, for example, ESL specialists or a math specialist to assist the regular classroom teachers with students who need extra help and so forth. Special education staffing is shown here as a separate item. And then as we get further down through the model, and I won't go into any great detail with these because they are described in the report that the commission has put out, but it shows supplies, administrative personnel, and so forth, sort of all the things that go into running a school are represented here. And this, again, is based on current conditions and the information that is used to fill in these cells to determine how many teachers, how much we spend on supplies, and so forth. That data comes from the database initiative, which I talked about on Tuesday. So that the database initiative really is the source. It's the key source of the data that allows this model to be built. Similarly, for middle schools, we have the same type of information. Obviously, middle schools are a different animal than elementary schools, so you'll see some slightly different categories here. But it's the same concept. We design a prototype that is intended to be a highly effective school and then determine the types of inputs required to make that happen. And then similar information for the high school. Middle school prototype assumes a school size of 500 students, high school 1,000 students. Now, obviously, we have a very broad range of school sizes in Oregon, ranging from, you know, 4 students up to well over 2,000 students in some of our largest high schools. So in that sense, the prototypes, again, are averages. The sizes of the prototypes were chosen based on research about the most effective school sizes. What does the research tell us is the most effective, most efficient size for a school? And so that, you know, what the research says is elementary schools of around 340. That, you know, obviously the research doesn't all agree on precisely the same size, but it tends to agree on rough ranges. And so these sizes were chosen to be consistent with what the research says. Now, at this point, I'm going to go to the table where the user of the model can vary or can do some policy scenarios, can change the inputs to the model to try to understand what the cost impacts are of doing of implementing various policy proposals. And you'll see here that we've termed policy assumptions are things that really are under the control of the schools or the legislature, or things that we have impact that we can change. For example, schools could choose to offer full-day kindergarten, or the legislature could choose to fund full-day kindergarten. I would contrast that with other assumptions in the model over which policymakers have little or no control: the inflation rate, health care costs, a number of other things. Maybe enrollment growth is something that we don't have direct control over. People will come to Oregon or leave Oregon for reasons that are outside the direct control of school districts or the legislature. So just as an example here, I often get asked how much it will it cost if we were to fund full-day kindergarten. So in this case, you'll see this column here represents current conditions in Oregon. We don't fund full-day kindergarten. In the second column, it shows, simply for comparison purposes, what the fully implemented quality education model calls for. And then the third column is the inputs actually used in the model currently. And so they are identical to the current situation over here in the first column. So I'm going to change this cell to yes, which will run, it'll send, create some changes in the model. Essentially what it does is add teachers and supplies to elementary schools in order to offer full-day kindergarten. And then I'll go to this next table, which will show us the impact. And for 05-07, the model estimates that would cost $93 million for the biennium to implement full-day kindergarten. Now,
Mr.
Yes.
Representative March. Thank you. Just to clarify that, so that's $93 million above our current conditions, not above the ideal.
Chair Devlin, Representative March, that's correct. The if you look on this page, the scenario that we're looking at right now is what we call the baseline funding level, which is really where we were back in 03-05 rolled up to 05-07. And you'll notice down here the total state school fund requirement is the same $5.318 billion that the School Revenue Forecast Committee has estimated. We calibrate the model to match that essential budget level estimate. That's our starting point. That's what it takes to do what we did last biennium. And from that starting point, we can do policy scenarios. Now, the governor has proposed that that number be $5 billion. So one of the scenarios we may want to do is what kind of cuts will be necessary to cut spending by $318 million. And we can do things like that. We can raise class sizes. So, for example, instead of having class sizes of 24 in kindergarten, we can set that at 25. And instead of having 25 in grades 1 through 3 and grades 4 through 5, we can raise those to 26. And then we can see how much money that saves us. And what that tells us is that saves us $55 million. Well, we need to save $318 million, so we need to go make some more cuts. This is the power of the model. It helps you understand what the nature of the cuts need to be to save that kind of money. I mean, one other thing, we can cut school days.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Reed, do we have access to this model? If we go on your website, it's on...
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, this model is not on the website, but I'm happy to provide it to you. It's an Excel spreadsheet. It's easy to use. It has a lot of detail in it, but I've set up these screens in the front that make it easy to change assumptions. So I'm happy to sit down with you and show you how it works at your convenience.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yeah.
That's why I have the floor. When you look at the Educational Service District, it's $118 per student times 1,000 students. Then you break that down. So is that additional, or is that the 118 below it on your high school?
On the high school?
Yeah. On the last page of the... You've got special education service, $118 per student, and then under that you've got all the different things they provide. So is that those numbers are added up twice, or is that the bottom line is justifying? I think they come out to 119, the bottom.
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisdom, I don't know what you mean by are they counted twice.
Well, just what I'm saying is I don't understand, is this the 118?
There's another line for instructional support, technology services, central services, and ESD admin. Those are all in addition to the special education.
That's correct.
Okay. Then, Mr. Chairman, one other question. When, Mr. Reeder, we had this in the interim, the QEM given to us, and I think a key question is when these people developed this QEM, how many school days did they use? And I'm still having a problem with the fact that we use school days, but the state requirement is hours.
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, you're correct. The state requirement is instructional hours. But in terms of modeling that, we chose to do it in terms of modeling the impact of cuts. We chose to do that on a school day basis simply because, in order to translate cutting instructional hours into dollar savings, I don't know how to do that in a meaningful way unless we say how many fewer days do we run a school. It's hard to understand how much savings there are by cutting 10 instructional hours unless you convert that into days that a school is actually in operation. So that's the reason we do it on a daily basis. And it's also true that teacher contracts are done on a day basis, not on an hour basis. So that's the logic behind that choice.
And how many days did we use for the model?
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, currently we assume that teachers have a 190-day contract. Now, that doesn't mean that school's in session 190 days, but when we're talking about cutting school days to save money, the way you translate that into savings is reducing the number of days that teachers and other employees are required to work. I would argue that you could express it either way. We simply chose to express it as a contract day concept rather than a day in session concept. But either way would, I think, would give you the same result.
Last yeah. question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So, how much does it cost? Because we've reduced, in the past, we've had to reduce the number of days, and how much does that equal each day? And, let's go there.
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, one of the inputs we have in here is length of school year. And as I said, we've expressed that in terms of how many teacher contract days. So right now, a typical, on average, teacher contract is 190 days. If we say we want to cut the school year by one day to save money, and so we only need 189 days from each teacher, we can put that in there. And 29.7 million dollars savings for each day that the school year is shortened.
Okay, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Can we specify that that's a training day? Or, in the past we've done this. We've had to reduce days. Can we, under the contracts that we have with the teachers, can we say you have to use a training day versus a class day?
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, I what the model does is show you the savings of, whether the teacher is, whatever they happen to be doing, if you're not paying them for one day, this is what your savings are, independent of what they happen to be doing with that day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would that be dependent at all on what the contract situation is in each school district in terms of, would most contracts allow you to go in and change the number of days?
Chair Devlin, I don't believe that districts can simply eliminate a day without the agreement of, that probably would violate their contract except under certain conditions. My understanding, although I'm not an expert on this, but if I believe state law says if the district has entirely run out of money, that they can close down their schools without the approval of the union.
One thing, Mr. Reeder, is that while the model, I think, is a very excellent tool for making projections, and it's probably the closest we can come in terms of making statewide estimates, wouldn't you agree, though, that the reality in an individual school district might be different from what the model would predict, in a sense? Because I'll give you a hypothetical example. A small school district with, say, an elementary school with only 200 students and 8 primary school teachers that has a classroom size of 25, they can actually cut a teacher, but they won't go to 26. If they cut a teacher, they'll go to about 28 or 29.
Chair Devlin, that's correct, and the model was never intended to replicate conditions in any particular district or any particular school. It was intended as a tool for the legislature to understand statewide conditions. And in that sense, these are averages, and obviously they don't apply to every school in the state. The commission is grappling with that very issue. What can we do to make the model more relevant to individual conditions in actual school districts and actual schools in Oregon?
Any additional questions at this time? Please proceed if there's any.
If you go down this list of what I've called policy inputs or policy assumptions, you can see all the types of things that you can change in the model to try and understand what the financial impacts of those are. Adding staff levels of different types, changing the length of the school year, which we just looked at, altering the number of professional development days that are provided to teachers, professional development for administrators. Right now, districts typically don't do that. They don't provide professional development for their administrators. So those are all zero in the baseline version of the model. Districts use consultants for various things. So that kind of information in there. Some of these assumptions are in here to help understand the impacts of doing things that districts currently aren't doing. A typical school district doesn't provide summer school. So we have assumptions in here about, what would it cost if districts did provide summer school? What would it cost to provide one-on-one tutoring for students, and so forth? And then it has assumptions about how much districts spend on classroom supplies, how much they spend on operations and maintenance, and so forth. Really a very wide range of things that the model user can change to try and understand the financial impacts. And finally, here at the bottom, I have provided the ability to change assumptions about things which in a lot of cases districts and the state don't have control over or don't have a lot of control over. The PERS rate, for example, the growth rate in teacher salaries, health insurance costs. Those are things that are really a function of economic conditions that individual school districts have little or no control over, but it may be interesting to understand what the impact of changing those are. Now, an obvious one here is PERS. When the Revenue Forecast Committee went through its exercise in December, the assumption was that the PERS rate would be 15.07. It may be considerably higher than that. So we can try and understand what the impact is if that rate were higher. And for example, if that rate were,
say, 16%
instead of 15.07, that would cost nearly $41 million statewide. So it gives us a sense of what those impacts are.
Take that to six. Leave that at 16, and change the health care to, say, let's say 15.
Those two things combined, $86 million. That's the power of the model as a policy tool. It helps you understand those cost impacts.
Yes.
Yes. Mr. Reeder, I think this is a very useful tool you have here, and I compliment you. I think that one of the things that disturbed me a little bit is in your characterization of salary and benefits as a separate entities, and they really should be characterized as a total entity, I believe. And I would like to see it broken down and into the various different, whether it be a principal or a teacher or whatever other employee, it broken down into a total salary plus, a total salary plus your take home, and then you divide it in, divide it up into your take home wage, your what part of that is benefits in the way of retirement, of medical premium, so forth, on an individualized basis. I think it would give us a better sense of some of the, what's really driving the cost of education if you could do that.
Chair Devlin, yeah. Senator Witt said, I believe it is broken down into those categories. We have a salary, we have benefits, we have, it's, as you can see, it's right here.
Yes, I think it would be, my point is it would be a little more, for me it would be more useful if it were more prominently displayed at the top. Here we have teacher salaries, principal salaries, and then we have benefits down here, and then we have contract benefits here, and then we bury it back here. We have actually how much your principals actually get, $106,000, $107,000, and also it'd be interesting to see on a broken down how many days are actually taught and how many days the employees are actually in the school, and what the benefits per day are of actual instruction.
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitson, I mean, with the information we have, I can provide that to you if you'd like to see that. I'd be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you.
And understanding that these are averages and may not represent an actual individual district in terms of what their current compensation structure is. Yeah.
Certainly. I think we're looking for cost drivers here. I think we should try to identify this.
Yes. Senator Nelson.
Are we going to get this spreadsheet, are you going to make it available to everybody so that we can play around with this thing?
Yes, I think actually Mr. Reeder said that he would be actually happy to meet with any one of us and actually give us the software so that we could probably utilize the spreadsheet or at least make it available to us. And I think it probably might take, to be realistic, it might take a few minutes to get us all up to speed so that we could actually utilize it.
And a follow-up, too, is where does the local funds and the federal funds play into this model? Are they part of this model, or how does that all work? Where's that show up?
Chair Devlin, yes. Senator Nelson, if you look on this, what I call the output table here, it really breaks these sources down. The way this works is the model estimates the total cost of running the schools, and then it takes into account the revenue sources. So, for example, here's the cost of running the prototypes. Add to that the ESD share. Add to that the high-cost disability fund. Add to that the expenditures of federal funds, and you get up to the $9 billion number, which would be a total funding requirement to run the schools at the level that we had in the prior biennium. Then you can start looking at revenue sources. Take out local revenue that doesn't go through the formula, which would be local option revenue and other private sources of funds that come into school districts. Take out the revenue from the federal government, and that gets you to a total amount that would go out through the state funding formula, which is both state and local money. Subtract from that how much we expect in local resources, which are primarily local property taxes, and that you then arrive at the amount that would be required from the state school fund. So it's all there for you to see.
Yes.
Jensen.
I understand this is, a model. But if we look at the other, as you referred to them, I think private funds, the model is based on some data assumptions you have about how much money there is out there, or is it? Have you just taken a grab at that?
Chair Devlin and Representative Jensen, we have very good data on all the sources of revenue that come into school districts, both from taxes, from the state school fund, as well as from private donations. If they show up on the books of the district, then we know what they are.
My understanding is they would be under the same kind of requirements that we would, and even if it was actually, like, we have to give budget authority to expend even donated funds to the state, to agencies, and they would be under the same kind of accounting requirements, so that they have to recognize that. There has to be an accounting for them within the school district audits and budget.
Chair Devlin, that is correct.
Where would you like to go from here?
At this point, I believe I'm finished with, sort of the overview of how the model works. I can email the model to all of you as soon as I get back to my office so you can look at it in more detail. There is a lot of stuff going on in this model. There are assumptions on growth rates of for inflation, for how quickly the price of textbooks are growing, a lot of detail, and you'll see those on a page here called parameters. A lot of detail on our assumptions about growth rates in various aspects of both, you know, growth rates in students, growth rates in the price of various inputs. And part of the logic behind this model is that we lay out all the assumptions for everyone to see them so that we can talk about whether they're reasonable or not, so that we're not hiding anything, and so it's all there for you to see. And if you have questions about, I do provide comments and data sources for each of these assumptions, so if you have any questions about those, I'm happy to answer them.
Are we going to get a briefing? Is Mr. Sager going to talk about the QEM, or is this the end of the QEM?
This is somewhat the end of the QEM, but Mr. Sager is going to relate some of the governor's statements to the QEM because it was based on the QEM model.
Okay. Yes. I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
Sure. One is for information for the committee on page 38 of the report. If you don't want to go on the computer or try to do this, there's some numbers there that we might talks about what savings or cost is to add days and a full day of kindergarten is $93 million, I think Mr. Reeder said $29.7 million for each day of instruction. It says $30 million here, so that gives us a ballpark.
Where are you looking at?
Page 38 of the
little box. Then
yeah. Okay, thank you.
And I guess, Mr. Reeder, like I said, we've gone over this this past summer. I guess with these people that have donated their time and effort to put this together, I don't see it. One of the pages talks about areas of needed research, and I don't see the group that's putting this together, you know, talking about evaluating the benefits of extended year, evaluate the effectiveness of ESDs, looking at federal and state mandates and funding, transportation costs, the structure and number of school districts. It says those are areas that need to be covered, I'm disappointed that maybe this group hasn't come forth with some more recommendations. I keep asking, you know, talking about leadership and helping us try to solve this problem. I think the next page there talks about fully integrating all sources of funding for the K-12 systems in a quality education model. And as Senator Nelson, I mean, I think you're being more transparent and giving that data there, but I think we need to keep talking about that. I'm concerned now we talked about, and we're going to get the governor's presentation, that we have more than $5 billion for education because our system is a shared system with local people and the state. And that total amount of money is $7.8 billion or somewhere in that ballpark, and we have to keep talking about that. You know, I'm a person that I like to be optimistic, and to just keep saying we don't have enough. We have almost $8 billion of money from the taxpayers, either through property tax or state income tax, and we've got to be showing the taxpayers that we're providing quality education.
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnett, I agree with you entirely, and part of the purpose of the model is to lay open how we spend all that money so that we can talk about it in common terms instead of just, you know, it's hard to put in context $8 billion. That's a lot of money. We all tend to, when we talk about that large of a sum, we try to put it in a personal context. Well, this is not a personal context. This is 550,000 children. So in order to understand what $8 billion means, we need to break it down, and that's what this model does.
Yes.
Mr. Reeder, on that box on 38, is that on page 38, is that biennial cost or is that a yearly cost?
Chair Devlin, Senator Witt said, those are biennial costs. I believe that the table should say that.
Yes, it does.
If it doesn't, it should.
All right. Then that if a 10% reduction would in administration would save $27 million, then that would indicate that the administration costs in districts are running about $270 million. Is that correct?
Chair Devlin and Senator Whitsitt, I think that's probably correct, yes.
And that would be exclusive of the $90 million that the Oregon Department of Education has as an administrative oversight.
That's correct.
So we're talking $360 million of administration.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
One thing, though, to state in terms of going back to some of our conversation on benefits and the relationship to the cost of employees, why don't you say you can clearly relate the cost of health care benefits to the individual employee. You cannot relate the cost of PERS to the individual employee, because PERS is actually an aggregate rate in terms of the cost of the system. A new teacher under the new retirement system will cost significantly less than that rate, but we are actually paying for the liabilities for the system, both for current employees and people that have actually already retired. So you can clearly relate the health care to the individual employees. You can't make as clear a relationship to that rate as if they were getting that much in benefits for retirement, because that's an aggregate rate for all, to cover the liabilities for all employees. So is there any additional questions for Mr. Reeder? Well, thank you very much for your presentation, and Mr. Sager is up now. And some of you have had a chance to read this before, and he's actually going to just walk through, I believe, the governor's what commonly is referred to, but maybe shouldn't be referred to, as ballot measure one statement, which is the voters approved it. And it basically is a requirement that the governor, when he submits the budget, needs to submit a statement indicating, I don't know if he'd have to submit it if he actually met the quality education model, but that he's to submit a statement to say why he dedicated the resources he or she did in their budget, and the differences in between this and the quality education model, and what his reasoning was for doing that.
Thank you, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. Good morning. For the record, I'm James Sager from the governor's office, and I have been asked to cover the kind of an overview of the governor's report on adequacy. Let me just for a moment kind of clarify what I think we've been trying to explain here about this report. The Ballot Measure 1 report is actually the report that is required from the legislature against the legislatively approved budget. In the implementation language that the legislature put in place, which is referred to as Oregon Revised Statute 291-228, the requirement was put in there that the governor, when he or she puts forward their proposed budget, has to also have a report. So this report is based upon the governor's presentation and proposed budget, and then at the end of the session, after you have approved the budget for education, then the legislature is to have the ballot measure one report. So it's a little confusing at times, and so there are actually two reports that come out, but we'll talk about this one today. The governor, and if you don't mind, I'd like to take just a couple minutes just to make sure that I try to put this into context of the entire budget, and then I want to kind of walk you through some of the parts, explain how it's connected to the quality education model that Mr. Reeder just walked us through, and then, of course, open up to your questions. The governor, as you know, constructed his proposed budget around his six principles. First, he made sure in constructing that budget that we met all the federal and state mandates. Those had to be paid for. And then he used his principles, and he measured all of the programs and needs in the state against those principles to try and lay out the parameter. The governor wanted to lay out clearly to Oregonians the limits of the state's current revenue picture. That is, he wanted to make it clear that the current revenue forecast that he must use to prepare this balanced budget could not meet the long list of important and valuable programs and needs expressed by Oregonians. And as he has stated, you know, any one of us could disagree with his priorities and the way he laid it out, and he supports a vigorous discussion around those kinds of priorities. But in the end, we have to have the discussion and make the decision as to how we balance all those priorities and thus fit it into the limits of the revenue picture for the state. In the past, this report has focused almost exclusively on K-12 education. This year, the governor, in keeping with his view that education is really an enterprise, that we must view it as a lifelong continuum as opposed to separate sectors, he expanded this report to include more comments about post-secondary education, a little bit about preschool or early childhood education in it, again, so that we can be viewing this on the continuum. The bottom line, and if you turn to on, oh, by the way, this report, in addition to it, my passing out these printed copies, can be found on the governor's webpage. So we posted this immediately, so again, all Oregonians can have access to this report. But the bottom line for the governor, and if you don't mind, I'd just like to quote at the top of page 2 of this printed document. He states, due to the current severe revenue shortfall, funds available under current law do not support the funding of state programs in the 2005-2007 biennium at the program levels in place for 2003-05 biennium. Because K-12 education alone takes up 45% of the general fund allocation, it is not possible to hold education harmless from the severe cuts the revenue shortfall requires us to make in order to balance the budget. So, starting on page 1 and several times throughout this document, he makes it clear that, in fact, this is not an adequate level of funding either for K-12 or any sector of the education system. It will not allow us to... meet the 90% goal that we set in this state when we put together the quality education model. And, of course, then the next significant step is to reach the requirements of No Child Left Behind, which say that 99% of our students must reach our high standards. And I think, as is probably stated in the commission's report, and I know Mr. Reeder has reported to others in the past, that that's going to be a significantly higher number. We research can't even tell us how high that number will go. The governor also recognized in his report that he acknowledged the ongoing contribution and dedication of our education workforce in the state, that despite budget cuts, they have year after year worked very hard to streamline operations and programs and to do everything they can to support student achievement in the process. The reality is, though, because of the continuing decrease in support and our inability as a state to provide the stable and adequate resources that the education community needs, there is a concern that, in fact, the flattening out of achievement growth that we have begun to see may continue. That, in fact, we cannot continue to ask the education community to do more and more every year with fewer and fewer resources. He did lay out a series of proposals to help move more dollars from the business side of the education system to direct services to students. And again, I want to make this clear on behalf of the governor that in no way does he believe that this closes that gap between the amount that is needed even to maintain current levels and the amount that he has proposed in his budget. But in fact, it is an effort to at least help mitigate some of those costs and provide some help. But he also wanted to make sure that at the K-12 level especially, that we provide a stable level of funding. one that we can be sustained and not have our districts and students put through another set of roller coaster rides like we have had for the past couple bienniums, where we start off the biennium believing we have one number of funding for schools. They set the program only to have that money taken away 6 months or a year later, and thus severe cuts take place, program cuts. The governor also states clearly, as I mentioned, that the budget is not adequate for our community colleges and our universities to maintain their quality programs either. But to help students, and that is always foremost in the mind of the governor, the impact all of these decisions in education have on students, to help students with the escalating costs of tuition, he has, which has closed the door to many of our not only traditional students but our adult population who wants to go back and further their education and their training. He has proposed an increase in the Oregon Opportunity Grants that will help our most needy Oregon students cover that increased expense, expand the number of students receiving assistance, and for the first time provide assistance to our part-time students. We know, the research shows, that they are the population most at risk trying to balance raising a family, taking care of their needs while they're trying to pursue the additional training and skill level that not only they want to have, but Oregon businesses need them to have in order for our economy and our businesses to remain competitive. He also proposed investing in deferred maintenance and capital construction needs for both our community colleges and our university. This is the first investment in our community colleges for over 25 years, and it is, in the governor's opinion, absolutely crucial. This investment will not only help protect the assets of Oregon's universities and community colleges, that is, keep our buildings and our structures sound, but it will also help meet the growing demand on these systems, and just as importantly, it's going to put hundreds of Oregonians across the state to work in family wage jobs supporting the protection of this infrastructure. And so, again, it becomes very much a win-win situation. Mr. Reeder just explained how dynamic the quality education model design is to look at K-12, the cost at a macro level. And again, I just want to emphasize that this isn't a model that looks at an individual school, but in fact looking at it statewide at the macro level. The governor, when he served as a member of the Oregon Supreme Court, served on the original Quality Education Commission that helped put this together. So he understands how dynamic and important this model can be. He used the model to understand the impacts of his budget decision on the system. And so in his report, and if I could point you to page 11 in the report, he lays out three examples. Here are three examples of the kinds of decisions that school districts will have to face in light of a $5.0 billion budget from the state. Not that these are the only decisions that they make, or that he is saying these are the areas that the school district should focus on, but again, simply using this model, saying what happens if we take $318 million out of the equation, what are the kinds of things that would have to change that school districts may have to grapple with. He lays out three examples. Again, this is the model of the report that has been used repeatedly, where the governors have used the quality education model to lay out examples of the impact that the school districts may have to face. The other, as you're looking at page 11, if you just look over at page 10 also, there's a second reference to the commission report. And Representative Wisnett, I think that you mentioned it earlier in your questioning, where in the report the commissioners laid out a series of recommendations and ideas. And so, again, the governor used that report from the commissioners to try and include in his budget and in his thinking some of the recommendations specifically from the report, in addition to looking at the impacts, and those being looking at this statewide education data system. It is part of his budget. Again, recognizing that that is a strategic investment that we need to make in the system, not only to help us help students be more successful, but if we're going to have an accountability system in the state, we need to have good data, and we need to have it put together in a format that is useful to the governor and the legislature. That aligning, improving the alignment of curriculum and assessment between the sectors, K-12, community college, and university system, to pay the highest cost of special education. Those kinds of elements came from the commissioners in the report, and the governor included that thinking in his presentation. The in addition, in this report, the governor tried to lay out very clearly kind of his vision of where he sees us today because of the financial condition we're in, how that affects education and looking out multiple years into the future instead of always just trying to live inside the two-year box that we're in, which is why we have included in the report the attachment and prior to the attachment some comments about the budget discipline that he has talked about, that in fact if we have budget discipline in our deliberations here, that not only can we provide stable funding for education. Now, again, we've always talked historically about stable and adequate funding for education, but as we've heard from many people, first let's get to stability and then we can move to adequacy because we're not providing either at this time. So first provide stable funding for schools. Build the rainy day fund, which I think we all agree we need to have in place, and with this kind of budget discipline we can actually build an education investment fund that will allow us to not just biennium to biennium try to struggle with how to maintain current service levels or where we need to cut, but in fact be able to invest in the education system at a level we've never been able to do before under the current system, and that amount by our projections would be in the neighborhood of $500 million a biennium. That would be a significant investment into the education system. So he has laid out all of those issues and concerns and visions in this report. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Jim, for the report. You know, I just feel like we're conflicted up here as a committee because, you know, we're looking at cutting costs and at everything that's all the evidence that's been presented to us saying, no, we need more money. And so, I mean, you know, the direct services to children, we're cutting pre-K, we're cutting the OPA program, we're cutting the Frontier Network. So that's why I'm saying, well, if I had the choice, I'm going to vote to implement those and cut things out of the Department of Education. Yet the Department of Education is providing some good data and some good services. And so how are we going to make this choice? That's my criticism of the governor and the governor's office is we put this all out, but there's nearly no solutions here. I mean, we all agree and all know we're in a bad financial situation. And if you approach it from the other direction, you know, that we need more money in the system, how are we going to get there? And, I think it's going to take the governor's office, elected leaders, particularly the executive branch, to figure out how we're going to do that. There are states in the United States, and even in this downturn, that have a surplus, that actually have money to spend. Eight of the 12 states that have a surplus are west of the Mississippi because they fill a particular niche. Hawaii has tourism, Nevada has gambling, and the rest of them basically are using natural resources. And yet, hearing from the governor's State of the State speech, he's basically taken away the possibility that we would be able to sell more electricity and perhaps put $100 million into the system because of the summer spill. We're going to have, it doesn't appear that he's going to try and find some solution as far as getting back and using some of our federal forest. I was in the Natural Resources Ways and Means Committee a couple days ago, and the Oregon Department of Forestry is saying, well, there's 1 billion board feet of lumber out there we should be able to cut on a sustainable basis. I mean, that's where the solution is. And so, you know, the legislature, we can say all that, but I think we really need the governor to step forward and say, this is a solution. I mean, what are we good at in Oregon? We raise trees. We're a good natural resource state. Jobs. Hal Sulwischer, who's the dean of forestry and at Oregon State University, basically has a plan. So with a billion board feet of lumber, I could create another 25,000 jobs. I mean, and I think that's the direction we need to go. So if I have any criticism of the governor's office, is that we all recognize a problem. What's the solution? Because otherwise, we're just going to become, we're not going to be any place. You know, we're not going to have people working. We got the highest poverty level, unemployment, hungry people. I'm disappointed in all this. So I think he has to make the case that there is a crisis out here, and this is how we solve it. So that's
sure. Chair Devlin and Senator Nelson. If you give me a moment, let me try to come at it from a little different perspective, because I don't think we disagree. Mm-hmm. The governor feels very strongly that Oregonians must come to understand the challenge that we're facing. In fact, the surveys and the feedback we get from average Oregonians is that they don't believe that all of us, the legislature, the governor's office, all involved with state government, are using our resources wisely. There was a lot of discussion that it was a lack of priorities as opposed to a lack of revenue, that discussion. And so the first step in this process, in the mind of the governor, is to lay out very clearly for Oregonians what the limits of the current revenue structure are. And let's have a conversation about that. Let's decide inside that limitation what those priorities are. He's laid a foundation for that discussion. He's laid out his priorities, or as best he could in the time frame he had, his priorities based on that budget. But let's have a conversation about that, because first we have to come to terms with the fact that if we have 500 items on our list of needs and we can only afford to pay for 300 of them, what do we do with the other 200 needs that are on the list? So first we have to come to terms with the reality of the budget. And if the decision of Oregonians working with the legislature and the governor is we really need to talk about other revenue sources to deal with this and to help build the economy, then let's have that conversation. Now, the governor has begun to push in certain areas. For instance, as I mentioned, the reason that he chose and feels very passionate about making the investment in deferred maintenance projects and capital constructions at the colleges and universities is because it puts Oregonians back to work. It stimulates the economy. It helps build the resource base for the state to be able to pay for the programs. Inside his budget, he tried to deal with those things that as governor he could clearly have an impact on, including, honestly, the triggering of the line games. He has the ability to ask the lottery commission to trigger that and to use that. But it is collectively working with the legislature and Oregonians that we need to discuss, are there other revenue issues, whether it's sustainable timber cuts and other issues, that we as Oregonians feel we need to discuss in order to generate additional revenue to meet the needs? And what are the trade-offs of those decisions? And to have that deliberative process. Far too many of the decisions that we've collectively here in this building find ourselves constrained under are not decisions that have been made through the deliberative process, but in fact through the initiative process. And as voters, we as Oregonians need to understand the relationship between those actions and the constraints we have. And so it's an education process that for the governor, he feels first we have to understand the constraints. He wants to be a part of the conversation and will help lead in coming up with solutions as we, as Oregonians, come together with that understanding.
So let me just follow up on that. Basically, what I'm hearing from everybody is we're literally billions of dollars short in fully funding, whether it's education or health care or public safety. We got all these problems. So we have to be thinking in, I think, in larger terms. I mean, if we, you know, we might pick up $10 million here, but $10 million there. But it's just never going to get to the point where we're ever going to solve the problem. We're going to just become a mediocre state if you believe the concept that we need to spend more money on education. I think most of us do believe that. We have to make that investment.
Senator Dillon and Senator Nelson, again, let me just say, I think Mr. Reeder touched on it a moment ago when we were talking about the impact of the $8 billion in education. For most of us, once we get above $500 or $5,000, the numbers become too large and we just don't have a grasp of it. And again, that has been a concern of the governor, how we can express clearly to Oregonians the impact of these decisions and the dollars. Because when we start throwing out even $10 million, the average person thinks, well, you've solved the problem. But the reality is, as you mentioned, we may have $1 billion or $2 billion hole. And it's hard to get our hands and our minds around that large a number unless we can break it down to the impact it has on us as Oregonians and the vision we have for the state.
Senator Whitsitt and Representative Jensen.
Chair Devlin, Mr. Sager, I'd like to refocus your attention on Senator Nelson's question and comments. While spending tax dollars to employ Oregonians is a good short-term fix, it is not a solution. In District 28, something like 68% of our district is owned by the federal government, forested land. Since 1987, the federal government has gone out of business. I would suggest to you that if you took any city or any municipality in the state and took that kind of a hit, you would have a major unemployment and poverty situation. And guess what? We do. The federal government is trying to get back into business. Yet our leadership is suggesting that that's not where we want to go in Oregon. I'm telling you, the people in our district want to go that direction. We want to be able to utilize those natural resources to rebuild our economy. Our economy has been built on that for a century, and we need to go back there. Use of water, agricultural land, those are the things that this state was built upon. And it does not seem to me that our leadership is leading us in that direction. And certainly from the second half of the governor's State of the State address, I would fear we're going in the other direction. So we need to, we need to have private sector jobs that are supported by the resources that we have, not private sector jobs that are hired by the taxpayers' money to build infrastructure. And again, while that's a good strategy for building a short-term solution, it is not a solution for the long term.
Thank you. Chair Devlin and Senator Whitsitt, again, I think that the governor agrees with you. It is the short-term impetus that he feels is needed to help get this economy back on track again. But long-term, it's providing stability and growth opportunities for not only Oregon businesses, but attracting other businesses in here, and providing a quality of life for Oregonians that can be sustained and that we can be proud of. The report that I'm presenting to you today regarding education, another point that the governor makes in this is it's not only the business climate, but it is, in fact, creating a sense in Oregonians that they are able to pursue their dreams of employment and work that is meaningful to them and thus meaningful to the state and supportive of the state, both as a worker, but more importantly, as a citizen of this state, and how we rebuild that sense of community in this state. And so, again, I think we have very similar values and very similar goals. We now have to discuss the how we make sure that we get there. He wants to provide some impetus to get this thing moving. Thank you.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to continue a little bit, I think, on what both Senator Nelson and Senator Whitsitt were saying. And I would applaud, I think, the governor's efforts to try to jumpstart a little bit the economy with some of the public works projects that you're referring to. But that's not a solution to what the problem we have in our economy in the state. It may give us a jump start. It may get an infusion of some dollars, kind of quickly into it. But we can't do this forever. And as a consequence, while I applaud it, I caution anybody, about holding it up as some sort of a banner of how great we are and what we're trying to get done here. The Yeah, we need the infusion of dollars from somewhere outside in the private sector, and Senator Nelson talks about very well the natural resource sector. And I'm reminded when I first came to this body in the legislative session of 1997, the state of Oregon was fourth in the nation in wheat production. Interestingly, Senator Nelson's home county and my home county were the number one county, was the number one county in the state for wheat production. The last figures I've seen on this is we're not even, Oregon isn't even in the wheat production business anymore. We're down, I think, to 12th in the nation, which is a pretty anemic showing as far as wheat production is concerned. Do farmers have a problem? Do wheat farmers have a problem? Is that a tough business? Well, obviously not. We've got one of our group here that's a wheat farmer, and he's doing very well, so it must be a pretty easy business. But the serious part of that point is other places, other states, other farmers are apparently able to make money growing wheat. Their wheat production has gone up. Ours has gone down. Now, you know, in and of itself, that's small potatoes. Didn't mean to cross crops here at the same time. But in and of itself, that's probably inconsequential. But if, in fact, as I suggest it is, reflecting the entire natural resource industry in this state, it no longer gets to be a small item. It gets to be a major item, especially in a state that has been so heavily dependent upon natural resources from day one. Mm-hmm. And we don't see the direction coming out of the governor's office about how do we jumpstart this crucial industry for us here in the state. How do we get some of us this back in gear? And in fact, as Senator Nelson pointed out, it seems to be the reverse that the governor is doing by saying when the federal government softens its position on some of these issues, we'll by gosh go in and sue them. I don't know whether that's a good way to jumpstart the natural resource industries in the state. And I don't know that we get out of this with, we replaced it one time with chips, not wood chips, natural resource, you know, but computer chips. And that worked great for a while. We wrote a real nice bubble on that. Everything went along very nice. And as inevitably will happen in those industries, the bubble breaks somewhere along the line. And Oregon probably never will command the same place in that particular industry as it had prior to the bubble breaking. Maybe there's something else that will, you know, turn this around. I'm waiting to hear. And when I find something else that will turn it around, I'll be delighted to get on board and push for it. But I don't think we can do it just by jump-starting in some capital construction items right now. That's not a question. That's an editorial.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I will just touch on a little bit, even though please, I am not an expert on natural resources and agriculture. I defer to all of you that have a lot more expertise in that area than I do. But the governor has repeatedly stated that he has no intention on turning his back on the traditional industries in this state, whether it be timber or agriculture, et cetera. Those are vital components of the future of this state. Within my office, Education Workforce Policy, we have been trying to work with our regional partners in a way where instead of the state dictating kind of the plan, that we're helping the regional teams and the local teams design the plan that is good to stimulate the economies in their area. That we recognize the fact that it's the local communities, it's the small business owner, it's the farmer, it's the agribusiness folks that are really integral, again, in the future of this state, that is not at the exclusion of high tech, because in fact a lot of these industries are remaining competitive because of technology, and so it's a blending of these industries and these talents in this state that together the governor hopes will create the sustainable economy that doesn't have these huge peaks and valleys that we have been going through over the past few decades. So again, I don't think that we have a great deal of disagreement as to the future and the outcome. Some of the paths that we're going to get there, we need to discuss, and the governor is looking forward to that kind of conversation so we can put together a cooperative, collaborative plan that is good for all parts of the state of Oregon.
Mr. Saker, I wanted to thank you for coming here. I had a couple of actual questions. One, what sort of message is the governor trying to send? And I'm trying to be careful here. When he is saying that if we do these things, we will be able to make investments that are much better for public education in the 2009 biennium. And I'll put this in relationship to a 7th or 8th grader in school now. Is he basically saying to that 7th or 8th grader, sorry, but we can't improve your education in the remaining period of years that you have in public education, that we will allow it to decline, you know, for the next two bienniums?
Chair Devlin, no, that is not what the governor is trying to communicate with the seventh grader or the parent of the first or second grader. In fact, if you look at the recent history, the last 4 to 6 years, we have had this roller coaster, and so we build up expectations only to have them dash in the system by pulling the money out partway through a biennium for various reasons, whether it's the economy or because the voters overturned a decision or whatever. So the governor is trying to lay a path that provides stability so that school districts can, in fact, plan for, based on the revenues that we can tell them they're going to have, the programs that they're going to be able to offer, so that there's stability there. Recognizing also that, as he states in his report, the folks in our education workforce in this state are doing an amazing job of trying to make ends meet to focus on the needs of students. And so they are trying to kind of fill the gaps that we as a state are not providing the revenues to do. And it's tough to call on them once again to say, continue to help us fill the gap, but in fact the dedication these folks have shown indicates that they will continue to do that. But if we continue down the path of not only spending every dollar we bring in, but in fact borrowing against the future and driving the hole deeper, then we never get to a point where we're not trying to get out of the hole. What the governor has laid out is a plan that says, if we're controlled now, we can actually begin to build not only the rainy day fund, which will help with the peaks and valleys, but a real investment fund in education where we can not just try to maintain current level, but really invest strategically in the programs that the quality education model says we need and the programs that we know we need at our community colleges, our universities, and in our early childhood program. So again, we're investing rather than scrambling to try and figure out how to patch up a gaping hole.
One of the things that I did appreciate in the governor's statement that you presented here today is his admission that at this funding level it would require school districts to make actual cuts in their programs. Now, I'm trying not to be difficult here,
but I'll just use your comparison. Your example one of what it would take to actually make up this difference: reduce support staff by 20%, 2,000 employees cut statewide, eliminate middle and high school counselors, 882 employees statewide, and replace textbooks half as often as currently done. If we are truly in, and we are truly in, a time of fiscal difficulty and scarcity of funds, I mean, this is practically, now it's not what the governor would probably prefer that districts do, but it's an option being given to them. When I came here in 97, I had a feeling that there was still kind of a feeling in this building of us versus them. There were our programs, and then there was public education. There was a lot of resentment that the new requirements put on the state by the voters in passage of Measure 5 was basically taking money away from our programs. Well, this is a potential of cutting almost 3,000 school employees. If this is a time of scarcity, there is literally no comparable cut in the number of actual state employees in this budget. I mean, there is literally no substantial cut of the actual number of state employees in this budget. How would I present this to a citizen that the governor's admitting that one of the ways that you might have to do this is to cut 3,000 or 2,800 school employees, but there's literally no comparable cut in terms of number of employees in state government?
Chair Devlin, let me approach it this way. Again, the requirement of this report is that the governor look at his proposed budget against the quality education model and the standards that we have set for our children, the goals that we have for our children. Using that model, and again, as Mr. Reeder tried to show with the variations of how you can use the model, these are simply examples of what it takes to cut from the current program level that schools have, which all estimates indicate would require $5.318 billion down to $5 billion. These are, again, these are macro numbers, just trying to give people a sense of the impact. The governor does not want to have to do this. One of the comments, and in fact I know it was a concern that was raised earlier in the week, if you turn back to page 9 in the report, and again, if you don't mind, just for the record, I think this will kind of lay out the what I'm trying to get at, is his statement: my recommended budget aligns current revenues of $11.9 billion general fund and lottery dollars to our highest needs of economic growth, the health and welfare of our citizens, and the education of our children and adults. Nonetheless, this still leads to reduction throughout the state budget to reconcile with the revenue gap. Given a larger amount of stable state revenue, I would have funded many additional programs, education programs primary among them, at higher levels. We simply do not have that luxury at this time. Our current revenue doesn't allow the governor to propose a balanced budget with education getting 5.3, and we would also probably be arguing, if it did, that 5.3 wasn't enough because we wanted to grow something. I mean, that is just a recognition. So again, the governor isn't saying this is where he wants schools to go. He isn't saying this is where he wants Oregon to go, but in the current revenue structure, trying to balance and prioritize all these needs, this is all he felt was available in the system for K-12 education. Now again, we can have the discussion and say we should move $200 million from some other program to K-12 education. Let's have that conversation. But then we also need to be just as clear and honest with Oregonians that the program or programs that lost the $200 million, what's the impact to Oregonians, whether it be children or seniors or disabled Oregonians, what's the impact on those Oregonians, just as the governor has tried to be honest and clear as to the impact of this decision.
And finally, one thing, the committee had a reference to this in one of our early overviews, and I don't actually have a copy for the committee. I just received this from my office. Mr. Bender had done an analysis that basically showed between 2003-05 and 2005-07 where increases in general fund and discretionary dollars had gone. And I think the committee remembers this, but it shows that in terms of those increases, $107 million had gone to human resources, $222 million to public safety, $13 million to the judicial branch, $31 to natural resources, and about $223 to other, most of the other being the set-aside, or a very high portion of it being a set-aside in terms of a compensation package in those very same divisions where those other increases. And the increase in actual general fund and discretionary fund to education was 0.1, which is $100,000, which would almost lead one to believe that basically what happened is we just redistributed the same amount of general fund and discretionary dollars among the education pie, virtually almost $100,000 in a $12 billion budget is virtually a rounding error. So one of the difficulties I have being in this position is I get more emails than many people do on the education budget. Not as many as the governor by any means. But I have to answer some of these questions. And this doesn't really particularly show very high priority being put on education, to be just perfectly blunt.
Chair Devlin, I received a copy of that presentation the other day and asked some folks to do some additional research. I'm sorry I didn't bring it with me today, not anticipating, but again, we'd be happy to sit down with you and kind of delve beneath the numbers so that we have a clear understanding. In putting together the current budget, using the $11.9 billion that we have, again, the governor tried to lay out what's mandated. Got to pay for that. Debt service that we've already committed to, we have to pay for that. He looked very closely at the impact of taking dollars, for instance, out of human services programs that might cut $5 in federal matching funds, so that we, you know, try to maximize those programs. And he has repeatedly stated that education is his is right at the top of his priority list. So it wasn't a desire to try and shift dollars. It was a desire to try and meet those priority needs in the limits that we have. We'd be happy to go into more detail on those numbers to understand the hydraulics of those decisions.
I'll leave it at that, Mr. Sager. I told you that I wouldn't try to shoot the messenger today.
Thank you, Senator.
Are there any additional questions?
Just one comment.
Yes.
Chair Devlin. We are jump-starting our economy with borrowed money, essentially. Mr. Sager, OTA 1, OTA 2, 3, now the new request for Connect Oregon. These are bonded items that we have to pay back. And investing in a future of a business is often a good is a good procedure, provided that we're certain that the returns, we will build a business that will be able to return that debt service. And I think that's one of the things we really need to keep in mind, that the short-term boost of the economy is not the required end. The required end is that we actually establish industry and we establish reestablish the timber and agriculture and forestry industries to the point, and other industries, to the point that they can repay this debt. Please comment.
Yes. Chair Devlin and Senator Woodsett, again, I appreciate your comments, and the governor agrees. To clarify some of the one of the positions of the governor, you're right. Investing in a business, investing in the future, especially if you're putting an investment in infrastructure, in capital investment, it makes sense. It's like buying a mortgage or buying your home, and you know over time it's going to improve in value. So he has been very clear that the borrowing of money is to be invested into the infrastructure, and in the short term, put Oregonians to work and to help get this economy moving, while at the same time carrying out all the activities that he is, and I know that you and the legislature are wanting to do, to help Oregon businesses grow and to help attract additional businesses into the state. So thank you.
Any additional questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Sager. To let the committee know where we will be going from this point forward,
Next Monday and Tuesday, we are going to be having four school districts come in on each day, their superintendents largely. And they will be talking about some of their situation in regard to the governor's budget, and they've been asked to answer several questions. One of the difficulties that we are going to have on Monday and Tuesday is we have four school districts on each day. So we have about 30 minutes per school district. So I've asked the parties to limit their presentations to about 15 minutes. And I've also asked, I'll also ask committee members to limit their questions to about 10 minutes. So as we go 30 minutes to 30 minutes, we will actually switch to the next school district because some of these school districts are coming from quite significant distances, so that we can get through them all, four on Monday and four on Tuesday. Then we go directly on Wednesday into community colleges and workforce development, both on Wednesday and Thursday, and we come back on the following Monday to finish up community colleges and workforce development to look at issues in terms of capital improvements for community colleges. We will probably, during the middle of this phase one process, I will be working with Ms. McGlashan, and we will try to come up with some methodology to basically have the discussion after phase one about priorities within the committee, so that that can be communicated to the chairs. One of the difficulties we have in doing that right now is we have not been given our marching orders from the co-chairs in terms of what our general parameters are within the committee in terms of resources, so that we will probably receive that word in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And so we'll try to start that discussion. Now, although we can't impact it directly, or at least we can't under the current system, and no one is advocating at this point changing the current system, we may do slightly different from the Department of Education in terms of looking at the state school fund, at least looking at what the impacts would be of these cuts, and at least looking in terms of what we think the impacts would be more appropriately handled, depending upon what final level we end up for school funding. I think the Department of Education did what they felt they needed to do. They broke down all the costs within the school district fund and then cut 10% out of each one to show what a 10% cut would. I think we have some duty as a committee to make some broader statement, at least, about what the higher priorities are within that. Obviously, the issues of central administration versus instruction, et cetera. So that's where we'll be going from this point forward. Hope that all of you are back on Monday. Hope that Senator Gordley is back on Monday. We have I think it's impacting staff quite a bit too. We have two different viruses going through the building. One that is causing some bronchial issues, and the other that's causing some other issues that are best probably not for public debate. So with that, are there any additional questions from the committee?
Are we meeting tomorrow for Ways and Means?
No, we are not. We are not. At least that's what I was told as of 9 o'clock last night. So, yes.
Mr. Chair, if I could just explain what you just received as a handout. I guess there was a question earlier as to what other states might be doing in terms of developing funding models along the lines of the Quality Education Commission's model. And Dr. Burke has prepared some information for you. He's happy to come up and spend about 5 minutes, if you like, just briefly telling you what's in the information, just kind of give you an overview, or if you like, you can take it and read it on your own.
I'm sensing that the committee...
Just read it.
Yeah, I'm sensing that the committee is eager to get to some other responsibilities. I'm sure Dr. Burke will be back to us sometime in the near future. And so please read it at your leisure, and thank you for providing the information to the committee. And with that, we are at, yes.
Could I ask that Mr. Reeder get us those that spreadsheet ASAP?
Yes.
That would not.
I think he promised as soon as he got back to his office he would have those sent to us.
That's probably faster than I can get to my office.
So, with that, we are adjourned.